Hi, everybody. My name is Lisa Wilson, and I am an alcoholic. And if I get too close, too loud, too fast, just let me know. I want to thank Milton for the invitation to come up here. This is the first time I've been here. Hannah's been after me for years to come up here, and it, just because of other conflicts within Alcoholics Anonymous, I've been unable. So now that I've rotated out, it's truly been an awesome weekend, one that I've definitely needed. And I want to thank Hannah for driving us up here. We came in her car, and we'll leave after Duke speaks tomorrow. And I want to thank Danny and Gail. That was totally awesome. And everyone, you know, you love when you're not the first speaker, and other people are saying, boy, they were so good. Boy, they're so good. And you're saying, oh, my God. And I don't have to worry about what I'm going to say, because as soon as I let God kick in, God's going to say what needs to be said. But it's good to hear that everyone gets nervous when they first get up here. And it took me a long time to get behind a microphone when I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. My first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous was sometime in 1991. Just want to tell you about that so I don't forget. And I got there not because I had a problem with drinking. It's my husband of the time had a problem with my drinking. And he had a friend who had a friend who had a friend that went to one of those A&A meetings. Now, mind you, my husband was an alcohol abuser. He'd fill up that glass with a drink and he'd take two sips and put it down and leave it. And, like, you know, I just never understood that. But he knew somebody that knew somebody, and they were going to take me to this meeting because he was sick and tired of me drinking, even though I, of course, denied it every day. He couldn't figure out why I would be falling off the rug or falling out of the shower, and I'd always tell him, and what's that on your breath? And it was mouthwash, and I have a migraine headache, or it's the sinuses. There was always an excuse. But he said he was going to leave me if I didn't go. I have never been self-supporting in my whole life, so, you know, what do? You go to an A&A meeting. So this gentleman came, it was a man, and he came and he picked us up, and I was so worried. I thought, Alcoholics Anonymous, you were going to teach me how to drink one or two drinks, and I've never done that. So I had my five drinks before I went to this meeting. And I was a closet drinker the last couple years of my drinking, and I had it hidden all over the house. So while he's visiting with my husband, I'm running to the bathroom, into the bedroom, and a couple other rooms to swig down some vodka and mouthwash. And I'm ready to go. I'm going to walk up those 13 steps to this meeting at the New Warrington Group in Pensacola, Florida. And it was supposed to be what he called the speaker meeting. I had no idea what a speaker meeting is. I'm sure he told me what it was, but I had no clue. My perception was definitely off. And it was storming horribly, and the speaker didn't show up. So they turned my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous into a gratitude meeting. Now, if you've never been to Alcoholics Anonymous and you were introduced to a gratitude meeting, I thought all you people were nuts. You were grateful for your DUIs, you were grateful for losing your families and getting them back, you were grateful for choosing the drink over your jobs, yada, yada, yada. And you know, I grew up as a member of the CIA, Catholic Irish Alcoholics, and we didn't talk about things. You know, you swept things under the rug, and I'm sitting there thinking, you people are crazy. You people are crazy. Well, I want to tell you, I left that meeting with 13 ladies' phone numbers. Not one of them did I want, not one of them did I need, and not one of them did I use. The big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and the stupid little silver chip that had 24 on it. Well, I threw that in the garbage that night, but I did read the big book. When I would come home for lunch every day from work, I would pour my 64 ounces of vodka with a splash of orange juice and sit down and read that book. And I, for some reason, I remembered the first 164 pages from that meeting. And you know, it had nothing to do with me. It was nice for you people, but it had nothing to do with me. So as they say, all those yets that were yet to come, well, they were yet to come, pretty much all of them. I grew up in Worcester, Massachusetts. That's where I was born. This is off. I'm using it for a clock so I don't get your bums sore. And I'm the second oldest of seven children. Someone here said that they were the only child, and I can remember always wanting to be that only child when you're growing up in a big household. But I was the second oldest, and I could say that, you know, my mother drank twice in her life, her whole life. You know, a couple sips, once because the bishop came to the house, and I can't even remember the other reason. And I'll never forget what she said. She says, I'm beginning to feel it, you know. Now, that was even before I started my drinking, but I remember hindsight, her saying that, I'm beginning to feel it. My dad would drink his beer after work, but nothing that I would call alcoholically. It's not for me to call anyway. But I had, it was wonderful. I had an older brother, and it was me, and then I had another younger brother and another younger brother, and life was good because I was the spoiled brat in the family. You know, the girl got what she wanted, and all the cousins and aunts and uncles, you know, I was one of the favorite ones. And then something happened. My mother had three other girls after that. Boom, boom, boom. And I never knew what a resentment was until I got into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had dislikes. I didn't have resentments. But, you know, I resented them. I definitely resented them because they took the attention away from me. And I didn't realize that till I got older. And I can tell you today we're very close. You know, we were very close. But the age gap growing up was hard. You know, I was a lot older than them. When I was 10 years old, my family sat us down at the table and they said that we were moving to Hollywood. And I was going to become a movie star. So I went to school that next day and I told all my classmates that we were moving to Hollywood, and they all the next week wrote little notes to all their favorite movie stars, and I was going to hand deliver them. And we get on the plane in a couple of weeks, and we get off at the airplane, and it says, "Welcome to Hollywood Fort Lauderdale International Airport." And I was so disappointed. You know, I could not write back to my classmates to tell them that I wasn't in Hollywood, California. It killed me. And I had a big resentment against my family my parents for a long time over that one. Life wasn't too adventurous growing up in Hollywood. I didn't make friends fast. You know, I was like I felt like the outcast. I only had a couple close friends. Hannah talks about all these friends that she meets for lunch, you know, 50 years later in school. And I know a lot of you have that, and I didn't have that. And I think that is so neat. You know, because it was about me. You know, and if it wasn't about me, then I didn't need you. I did have a few close friends that I hung around in school, but that was all. I didn't make friends quick or fast because, you know, if you didn't have what I wanted, then you weren't worth being in my life. I had my first drink when I was, I think, 15 or 16, and several of us went to 7-Elevens. I don't know if you know this little dew drop-in convenience store. And we paid someone to go in and buy us a bottle of Boone's Farm Strawberry Hill wine. From olive oil, I became Dolly Parton in the next hour. I'm telling you, that stuff was good. It made me feel good. It made me really feel good. I was important. I was beautiful. I was everything that I wasn't when I wasn't drinking. Now I can say for the next couple of years in high school, we didn't do it that often, but we did do it every now and then. And I can tell you, every time I picked up that drink, it was never one. It was never one. I always wanted more. And my dad did have some bottles of liquor up in the cabinet in the front hall. And what I would end up doing, you know, over the months is when they got lower and lower, because they would hardly ever go there, I'd just fill it up with water and food coloring. You know, so when he had his friends come over, who knows what they thought. And I really didn't care. When I was now being raised Catholic, I was raised, my mother was a very devout Catholic. And we did do things in the church and help out in the church, but I had no connection with this power greater than myself as I was growing up. I think one time I felt it when I was in seventh grade. But besides that, it was just going and doing the kneeling, the standing, the sitting, the, you know, helping out in the kitchen whenever they needed it at church or whatever they needed at church. But there was no ever connection. But I did pray to God. But God was there and I was here. I had no understanding of a God in my life growing up. My father, we never went to church with him because he went to that 3:30 a.m. Mass at church. And I was to come to find out there was never a 3:30 a.m. Mass, but that's okay. We had everything we possibly needed. We had all of our needs met. We never went without food or clothing or going to the dentist or the doctor or whatever. We had it all. But the reason I say growing up Catholic, my mother was very devout, and, you know, we talked about things. And here at 17, I fell in lust with my first boyfriend, and we had sex, and I didn't know of anyone that could get pregnant that first time, but I got pregnant, and that was, to me, was a big, oh my gosh, how I've disappointed my mother. And anyway, when I went and told my mother, the first thing she said to me, and yes, I did, was drinking that night, and listen to this, my mother says, "Well, who's the father?" Now, I think this sounds better. I said, "I don't know if it's Barry or Danny," or I thought that sounded better if I put three or four guys' names in there. God, can you imagine being a mother and your daughter telling you you've got five people, you don't know who the father is? And that's because you drank and you don't know who you ended up in the bed with? You know, that took a long time getting over with when I got sober and facing that reality, because I had morals. You know, I grew up with morals, and I was so ashamed. But I knew who the father was. I really knew who the father was, and his name is Barry. Well, Barry thought it would be a good idea to get away from Hollywood, that we should go live up in the mountains and be mountain people. So he moved us to the West by God, Virginia, Hinton, West Virginia. And it's a little town with one blinking light in it. We knew one person there. He had one friend that he knew. And once we lived at the top of the mountain to begin with in a little four-room house that we had to put tape on the slats so the snow wouldn't blow in. We had an outhouse and a number three wash tub and a cook stove. Now, Massachusetts in the city, South Florida in the city, and here I'm going to East Jesus. And I haven't a clue. You know, I haven't a clue. So anyway, we do the deal. I have Phil. My first son was born in 1975, and thank God healthy. You know, because I did do some drinking during my pregnancy. I didn't do a lot because it made me sick, but every time I could drink a beer or two, I would. And when I was in that delivery room, I'll tell you what happened, is this lady next to me, she apparently was a drug addict or something, because her child was born with three eyes on its face, and it didn't live long. And I knew that from hearing the nurses talking, and I was scared to death. I was scared to death that my son was going to be, well, I didn't know it was a boy at the time. They didn't do those tests back then, little ultrasounds. But Phil was born healthy, and I was so grateful. I didn't drink that much during my pregnancy, but I'll tell you what happened afterwards. My husband used to always take off on the weekends. He'd leave on Friday and come back on Sunday and go to these mountain parties. And I had no idea what a real mountain party was and never went to, but I know he'd come back real happy and real hungover, and I wanted to see what was going on with those things. So we got to know these people real good, elderly people, my age now. I called them elderly back then. Ones that we trusted with watching the kids, me and this other, the friends that we had also had one child. So the first week, and he was probably 3 months old. We had them watch the kids. We went up the mountain, and I'm telling you, I was introduced to moonshine, and I know I had arrived. That was the smoothest stuff going down. I know there's rock gut moonshine, too, because I've had that, too. But man, I could not wait. I could not wait to go to that. And the women outdrank the men, left and right, you know, and I had to be part of. So I was going to drink just as much as them women did. And we had a great time. That's what I would have told you. What I realized today is I was trying to get that same effect that I had when I had that first drink of Boone's Farm Strawberry Hill Wine. And I was to chase that until I was 36 years old and came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. Before I forget, my sobriety date is October the 26th, 1992. By God's grace, I made it back here. I have a sponsor, Pat, and she lives in Dufuniac Springs, and she has a sponsor, and Susie has a sponsor, and they're all very active in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and for that, I am truly grateful that I learned how to do different from them. We were to live in, I was to get pregnant again, and just to fast forward here, 2 years later with my second son, Barry. He was born in 1978. And again, when I was pregnant, I couldn't drink. I got deathly ill. But I can tell you the in-between times, it was at least once a month or at least once every 3 months that we would go to a mountain party and leave these kids with someone that I knew. Now, this is the time before cell phones. No contact at all. But I'm a good mom. I would have told you I was a good mom, but I left those kids alone. There would be no way for them to get a hold of us. Because going up and down some of those mountains, I know you guys got some here. You need a four-wheel drive. But I was a good mom. After 5 years of living there, and it was rough. We didn't just live at the top of the mountain. Sometimes we lived by the river, by the gorge, by Blue Stone State Park, because we didn't have enough money for rent or whatever. When we lived down in Jumping Branch, I'll never forget this older woman, and I got to make amends to her 23 years after we moved there. But she lived next door to us, and again, we were very poor. We had the outhouse, which, God, I don't ever want to do again. The number three wash tub, the cook stove, he hunted for the food. I cooked, but we didn't have a lot of money, so every day at noontime, I would conveniently go over to her house, and she would nicely feed the kids, and she'd always say, now, I'm talking about foolish pride, she'd say, aren't you hungry? I'd be starving, and I'd say, oh, no, 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 I'm not hungry, because I didn't want her to know that we didn't have. But I would clean up the table for her, and as I'm going from the dining room to the kitchen, you know, I'm so when I get home. And we got to make amends to that woman, and she knew. But 5 years after living there, my husband said, it's just, you know, I can tell you I wasn't a wife to that man. I didn't want to be there doing the things I was doing with him or anyone else. I just didn't want to be there, and it snows, and it's cold, and it's not what I was used to. So we moved down. He said, why don't you go live back with your parents, and I'll get our stuff together, and we didn't have much, and I'll come down in about a month, and I'll bring everything. And I said, okay, fine. So moved back with my parents with two children. Waited for him. I ended up getting a job with a neurosurgeon because he thought I needed brain surgery, I guess, my one brain cell. One on a respirator, one blinking. And he came down a month later in our little VW beat-up bug at that time. And when he got up to Hollywood, he calls me and he says that he's really tired. He got a little efficiency apartment. Now he hasn't seen his kids for a month, and he was a good dad. He said, "I'll see you tomorrow or the next day. I'm really tired." Now, I thought that was a little bit suspicious. I had an intuitive thought. So I borrowed my mom's car, and I went down to that little Dewdrop-In hotel, and I knocked on that door, and a woman opened the door. And I said, "Oh, I'm sorry. I must have the wrong room." And Barry goes, "No, you have the right room." And I just died. You know, I just died. Now, look, in hindsight, again, I can tell you I was never a wife to that man. I was very resentful for where he brought us. And to think all those resentments were all me, but I put it all on him, and I made him a miserable man. He had every right to go find some peace and some happiness. Before I forget, I can tell you today that our Christmases, our Easters, our Thanksgivings are spent, and here we go. It's my first husband and a second wife, my second husband and his girlfriend, because he said I've cured him of ever getting married again, all the grandkids, and we all get along, and that's only because of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, only because of that. Anyway, he took off. Barry said that he didn't want a divorce, didn't want anything to do with the kids, and I have permission to share this from him after I made amends. And he just took off. We did get a divorce. I had to end up getting a sheriff to serve him the papers. There was a two-year period that I lived with my parents, and I went out one time with a school friend, a male friend of mine. He said, "Why don't you just come out for a drink or two?" Now, I know nothing about the obsession. I know nothing about the physical allergy. But I can tell you, looking back, every time I picked up that drink, it couldn't be one, it had to be more. And if I didn't have any more, I was not a nice person to be around. So I went out with Dan one night with all the intentions of going out for one drink. We left at 9:30 after the kids were in bed. Mom and Dad said, "Fine, have a good time. We'll see you when you get in." Well, of course, you know, there was no curfew or anything. But I woke up at 6 o'clock that next morning, doing the things that I, one more time, that I didn't want to do, that I didn't need to do, and all because of alcohol. I couldn't tell you how we got there. Couldn't tell you what we did. Well, I know what we did. But but that one more time, that utter demoralization. You know, that utter demoralization, knowing him or not knowing him. One time in 2 years. Anyway, Barry took off, and when my oldest son was three, the youngest one was 1 year old, and I'll tell you this for a reason. My mother, thank God for my mother, she loved you people. Every meeting I went to, she'd say, "Tell your people I love them. Tell your people I love them." But my mom said, "Don't you ever say anything bad about that man, because it'll come back to bite you." So when my oldest son, Phil, would ask, "Where's Daddy?" I'd tell him he's on a slow boat to China. He'll come back when you're 18. And every time, for 3 months, he would ask, "Where's Daddy?" "On a slow boat to China. He'll come back when you're 18. His parents didn't hear from him. His sister, none of his friends. He just disappeared from the face of the earth. We had no idea where he was. Well, after 2 years, my former mother-in-law from my first husband, Barry, they were having a family reunion in Pensacola, Florida. And she asked me to bring, if I would bring the kids up to this family reunion so there could be a picture of the six generations. He had a sister, too, so that was the filling gap for that generation. So I said, of course, because, you know, I didn't divorce them. Wonderful in-laws. You know, awesome to this day. So we went up to Pensacola, Florida for the family reunion, and I'm telling you, I never experienced so much love within a whole. All of our family was spread apart as far as cousins, uncles, whatever, and they all lived in Pensacola, Florida. It was an awesome weekend. And my father-in-law had a house that was just sitting there because at this time they moved to Missouri, a little small house in Pensacola. And he said to me, he said, "You know, do you ever think of moving?" He said, "You know, if you want to, you can come up and just take over this house here that we're not using." And I thought, oh, to get out of my parents' house, wouldn't that be nice? But, you know, I've never been self-supporting through my own contributions my whole life. It was, you know, from my parents to my first husband back to my parents. So I told him, no, I didn't think I could do that, you know, fear, total fear. So I went home, and my brother, who had just broken, he broke his neck in a car accident and just got his little settlement, and he was living back at the house for that reason. He had one of those halo braces screwed in. He went out drinking one night and got drunk and fell in the bathtub and clunk that brace into his brain, but he's fine today. But I asked him, I said, that's what we do. I said, do you want to move up to Pensacola? And that's how I got to Pensacola. My brother said, yes, let's get out of mom and dad's house. So we moved together to Pensacola, Florida, me and my younger brother. And boy, I had a built-in babysitter. It was awesome. My job there was working for a nephrologist. I started an office with five women who were recently divorced and liked to party. Now, mind you, I'd been out once in 2 years, and I want to fit in here. You know, I want to fit in and make some friends real quick, you know, because it was awful that 2 years. I had no friends at all to talk to or anything about my emotions. What about me? So anyway, us ladies would start to go out on Wednesday night when it was buy one, get one free. And, you know, I'm a good mom because I would leave those kids with my brother. And I wouldn't leave until they were in bed after school. So I'm a good mom. And I always made sure I made it home that next morning before they get up to go to school. So I thought. I had all intentions every time I would go out with those women to have a few drinks. And alcohol caused me to drink against my will. And alcohol brought me to sordid places. You know, I didn't always go home with in my car or who I rode with. And I'm not proud to say that today, but I'm proud to tell you that I don't do that today anymore. And that's the gift of this program. I was to find my second hostage, husband, as we were partying. His name is Reese. And the boys were probably 5 and 7 years old, or right around that age, maybe a little bit older. And I can tell you I could not have found a better man to raise two kids that were not his own. I was definitely blessed with him in my life. And we had fun for those first few years. He should have known when we were going out and dating, because we dated for a good year and a half. And that was 1985. 1982 is when I moved to Pensacola. But he, you know, I would always get wasted when I was out with him. And here he is with that little teetotaler, take one or two drinks. And, you know, it's my responsibility to finish that drink. I've got to do it. Well, by 1987, 1988, he's getting tired of my drinking. You know, and he says to me, and you've heard this before, I think you're drinking too much. You know, and my thought is I haven't had enough. So that's when you become the closet drinker and you hide little bottles of 7-Up all throughout the house. You know, you put it in your purse and your purse is hanging on the hanger over your jacket so we can't find it, or way back behind the pans so we can't find it. You know, but I'm not hurting anyone. I'm not hurting anyone. Why doesn't he just get off my back? I had a good job at the time. I worked for a hospital research and development institute. I worked there 5 years as a drunk and 4 years sober. And part of it was an advertising agency for things like the responsible drinking program, the waterfront rescue mission, New Hope Home, which was a recovery center, Salvation Army program that they had for recovering alcoholics and addicts. And what my boss would do is gather all this information on alcoholism or addiction, give it to me to type up and put in pamphlet form. And I would sit there thinking, he thinks I'm an alcoholic. He thinks I'm an alcoholic. He never said anything. And I know that big book of Alcoholics Anonymous was on my desk at one time, but I couldn't tell you anything it said in it. All I could remember thinking is, he thinks I'm an alcoholic. The alcohol started off being fun. With that Boone's Farm. It started off being fun. And then something happened along the years. By 1987, it became a habit. You know, I couldn't wait till Friday night to go out with the girls or with Reese. Or I couldn't wait till Saturday night. Oh, all week long, obsess over it, not realizing the obsession. And then it became a necessity, 24/7. And I know it doesn't happen like that for some people, but it happened. That was my story. If I didn't have it, I would definitely have the DTs. By 1987, I started going to little emergency rooms, and it could have been 89. Little emergency rooms or emergency centers, you know, I wanted that spelt figure so when I drank, I didn't eat. I thought 99 pounds looked real good on me, and I looked like death warmed over. I would take, you know, I was the good mom, I was the PTA mom, I was the team mom for the baseball or the football or whatever it is, not realizing, you know, and if it wasn't done my way, I didn't need you to help me out. I was going to do it all. And I did everything for everybody, and they didn't appreciate me. And I couldn't understand that. Could not understand. You understand that, Dirk, don't you? A lot of amends to make here along the roads. Stepped on a lot of people in a lot of places. I remember One time, Reese had taken the keys away from me from my car, and he took the boys to the field to play baseball. And I said, I'll show him. Of course, you know, I had six or seven drinks, and I walked to the park. I embarrassed my children to death. He threw me in the car and took me home. Clueless, totally clueless about how I affected my family. By 1989, between 87 and 89, what I would do is I would drink so much that I would get so sick, the heart pounding, the numbness of the arms and the legs. The minute you bend over, you feel like you were going to pass out. I couldn't tell you what was left and what was right, but I'd end up in an emergency room in an emergency center. I went to a total of, I think, 37, somewhere around that, different ones every time. Because what I found out is if you go to one and you go back to them in another couple weeks, they pull out your old records, and they tell you that your blood work was way out of whack 2 weeks ago. Why didn't you come back when we asked you to? So you just go to a different one every time. That way they can't check the old records. And, of course, you do this without the husband's knowledge because you don't want him to know how far down the scale you have gone, because you're telling him every day when he's asking you, why are you falling off the rug? Why are you falling out of the shower? That you have migraines, or, you know, it's your sinuses, or you don't know. What's that on your breath? It's mouthwash. You know, that poor man was in denial big time himself. Well, by 1990, my dad was real sick, and things were going on there, but, you know, I didn't care because it was about me. But I ended up going to this one emergency center, and I always got the call the next day or two from them saying that your blood works. And what I would go is for the IVs, for the dehydration, the shot, for the nausea and vomiting, all their medicine that they could give me to get better. And I swear, I'm not going to do this again. I am not going to ever do this again. And you know, one more time, you pick up again. But anyway, Reese got the call from that emergency room center. And I hear him saying, schedule it. So he gets off the phone, he says, so you've been drinking, huh? And what do we say? Not me. He says, well, good, because you're going to go have a liver biopsy next week because the blood work was so out of whack. So I white-knuckled it for that whole week, thinking, you know, that it would all be out of my system, that nothing was going to show up because, you know, here we go with the threats. I'm going to leave you if you ever drink again. So we go and have the liver biopsy, and by that time, I can't even wear stretch pants. My whole side is like a balloon. And I lay down on the table, and the little guy takes a mark, and he outlines the liver. Well, he starts here and he goes all the way over here. And I said, I didn't realize your liver was that big. And a little smart butt said, it's not. You know, like he probably smelled the alcohol on my breath because I know I had a drink before I went. I was so fearful. And they pulled out that big needle and stuck it in. I can remember how painful it was. And I'm thinking, well, what now? And the doctor said, well, we'll give you results in a couple days. Well, a couple days later, I can't remember who called the nurse, I'm sure. And it's one thing about perception. And I can tell you my perception was off, because this is what I heard. You have hepatitis, you're going to die in a year. Come back to see us. Clunk. And that's all I heard. I have no idea truly to this day what they said. I don't remember them saying anything about going to get help or anything. But I know that scared the heck out of me. And I didn't know what to do. Because alcohol, everything revolved around alcohol. Where I went, how long I went there, who I went with. And it scared me enough for 3 whole months I didn't have a drink. And my husband just loved it, you know. I was the witchiest witch that you could ever know for that 3 months. Because I had no program, no outlet, no one to talk to. I had no friends, not even the people in the office by that time. Poor me, poor me, poor me. Well, at 3 months sober, something was to happen. My son and his friends, who were all straight-A students, decided that one night they were all spending the night at someone's house, you know. And, well, you know how kids do. You know, I'm spending the night over here, but they're really not there. Well, anyway, that next morning, I get a call from the Gulf Breeze Police Department. All 6 of them were charged with breaking and entering, and I have permission to share that. And their rationalization and justification was they were not breaking and entering in cars because they were open. They were not locked. So how do you like that one? Yeah, I can understand that. Can't you understand that? So we go get them out of jail. And very short time later, we had to go before the judge. And man, I was nervous. I was irritable. Restless, irritable, and discontent. So I just felt the need, before we went to court that morning at 7 o'clock in the morning, to go around the corner to my little Dewdrop-In man, that little bar that opened at 7 o'clock, and get a little pony of vodka. Just a little one. So I got that, started to drive home. Well, I wasn't 3 minutes away from that place. And by the time I got to my driveway, I thought, oh, that didn't even do anything. I have to go back. Got a little half pint. Suck that down. I can tell you on the way home from that journey to the judge, I stopped and just said the heck with it and went and got a half a gallon of vodka. Off and running one more time. Cunning, baffling, and powerful. With all intentions of just getting the edge off, getting that edge off, and I'm right back to. I can tell you within the next 2 weeks, it was pure hell because alcohol stopped working for me. It didn't get me drunk and it didn't get me sober. And I don't know if you've ever been there, but it was a scary place to be. I called myself the Night of the Living Dead, and I didn't know what to do. And my husband didn't know what to do. You know, he knew I was drinking, and he said he was going to leave me. And at that point, I said, I just didn't care. I just didn't care. Well, the kids went to school one morning. I'm going to back up a little bit. After that liver biopsy, shortly after that liver biopsy, my mom called us home because Dad wasn't going to make it. And my dad was not one to say, I love you. My dad would do things in different ways, put up shelves for you, buy you something. That's how my dad, he was not a verbal person or a hugger. And that was one thing when I first got into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. For me, my dad never told me he loved me. And that's not true. On his deathbed, he did. He couldn't talk, but he wrote a note. Now, mind you, I'm under 99 pounds. And he writes a note and he says, Lisa, I just want you to know I love you. And I remember my thought at that time is, Dad, if you only knew I'm dying. I'm dying inside. He gave me a little peck on the cheek. My dad told me he loved me. And I knew that all along after getting into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and looking hindsight. But you know, it just didn't matter. Life just didn't matter anymore. The husband and the kids went off to school. Husband went to work and I couldn't function. Alcohol had done something. I had gotten to the point now where I knew what my hands would do, but I couldn't even go to open the front door. I would say, now, Lisa, just go open the front door with your hand and go to work. And it wouldn't work. This knew it, but this couldn't act to it. I sat down on the kitchen table, and I truly didn't know what to do. I couldn't pick up the phone and call anyone. And about the finishing the half bottle of vodka, because I kept on drinking, because utter despair, I didn't know what to do. I said, that's it. I got up. I went into my husband's room. He always kept a gun underneath the pillow because he thought someone was out to get us. He didn't realize it was me. And anyway, I went and got the gun. And I went in the bathroom. And I can remember praying. You know, I used to pray over that commode every morning. God help me. Every morning to that porcelain God. And that throwing up that vial. Things is awful. And I sat down on that toilet, and guess what? The gun didn't do what it was supposed to do. And the next thing I remember is my son coming home from school and opening the bathroom door. And I remember him as calling his daddy, and I remember us going to the hospital. And I remember us sitting there what seemed to be a whole day, just waiting, waiting, waiting. And this doctor came in, and he looks at me, and he says, and by that time, too, I remember those white blisters all over my mouth and in my tongue. And he says to me, do you know why you're here? And I blurted out the word alcohol. You know what my husband says? She doesn't drink. Talk about denial big time, huh? She doesn't drink. But I'll never forget what that doctor said. He looked at me and he said, do you want help? And I can tell you at that moment, I didn't know about treatment centers. I didn't know, really, I knew that one meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, but I didn't know if you need to sign up or do whatever you needed to do. It didn't matter. I wasn't ready. And I can just remember that feeling, that utter relief. Yes, I want help. So I went into the rooms of Discovery, a treatment center. And the rooms of Discovery, they talked about the rooms of recovery, the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And you brought meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous every day and sometimes twice a day into that treatment center. And I didn't understand anything. I couldn't pull my pants up. I couldn't brush my hair. They put me in this room with this 21-year-old pukey, bubbly girl who had been there for 28 days and found God, and she was going home the next day. Well, I was going to help her go home that next day because I put my hands around her neck, and it took three nurses to get me loose. And that's how you get a private room, ladies. They don't let nobody else around you. But I remember you people bringing the message of Alcoholics Anonymous in there, and I was clueless. I was totally clueless. And you would always say that serenity prayer, and I took a permanent marker because I couldn't remember anything, and I didn't want you to think I was stupid. I just really wanted to die, and I wrote the serenity prayer on my hand in permanent marker. And I'll tell you, for the whole time I was there, I didn't wash that off my hand. Because as we stood after the meetings, I wanted to look down and I wanted to say that prayer, because you people that brought in the meetings, not so much the patients there, but you people that brought in the meetings, you had something, and I didn't know what it was. And I know I didn't want to drink anymore, and I knew I didn't know how to not drink anymore. We were across the street from a hospital, and I can remember going out to the window and just looking across the street at the hospital, just thinking to myself, all those people over there dying to live, and I'm living to die, and I didn't know how. Because things weren't clicking, you know, they give you medicine, and they tell you after 3 days you'll get a little more clarity, and after 5 days you'll get a little more clarity. Well, at least it's taking longer for you. After 7 days, you'll get a little bit more clarity, and it wasn't working. And at day 10, when it still wasn't working, it was awful. They suggested that I was going to go to this nice place called Chattahoochee. Now, I did not know what a Chattahoochee was. I don't know if you all do. It's a nice place down the street in Florida somewhere for little wet brains. So we were sitting in group that next day, and I asked the people that had been there before. One guy had been there 75 times. I couldn't believe it, thinking to myself, it doesn't work. It doesn't work. And I asked him about Chattahoochee, and he shared about Chattahoochee because he was there. And I knew I wasn't going to Chattahoochee. But he also shared on how you could commit suicide in the rooms in the treatment center, and that's what I was going to do. So I went down that next night, and I asked for the last rites. I asked them to call the priest to give me last rites. The priest didn't show up. How do you like that? Can't trust anyone these days. Anyway, he didn't show up, so I went down to the room to get my last cigarette. It was a big, long hallway, and the living quarters were on this side, and then the meeting rooms were on this side. And one of the meeting rooms had the steps and the traditions hanging up. And I remember going down to get my last cigarette because, you know, I just couldn't live that way, and I wasn't going to Chattahoochee. I was the scum of the earth, the scum of the earth. Now, mind you, I had never had a DUI. I had never lost a job. What I lost was me, complete me. I didn't need to lose that other stuff. I was a prisoner in my own body. Couldn't go anywhere, do anything. So I got my last cigarette, and I'm walking down the hallway, and I can read, but I don't know what the words aren't registering. I mean, we's not registering. Admitted's not. Nothing is registering. I'm walking down to the smoke room to get my last cigarette, and I stop at the meeting room, and I turn over, and I start reading, we admitted we were powerless over, and the words started to make sense. The words started to make sense. Now, every day I needed someone to help me get dressed. I mean, it was the most weirdest thing. You know, I couldn't do anything, but I can put my hands around this girl's neck, so some things were still working. So I went running down to the nurse's station, letting him know I can read, I can read, I can read, I know what my pants are, I know what, I'm lifting my shirt off. They ended up giving me a shot of something to calm me down because I was so excited, you know, over this, that I didn't have to die, that I didn't have to die. That next morning when I woke up, we had private counselors there also. And Gary, she was a female, and she was awesome. She came in to talk to me. She goes, Lisa, what happened yesterday? And so I told her. I said, when I went back to my room to get my last cigarette because I was going to kill myself, I know I prayed. I don't know if I prayed on my knees. I don't know if it was that prayer of desperation. I don't know if I prayed over the commode. I don't know, but I know I said, God help me. And it went from here to here. She said, well, I don't know what happened to you, Lisa, but you better take with it and you better run with it. So it was like 3 or 4 days after that I got out of the treatment center. I didn't stay for the full 28 days. I was there for like 15, 16 days. But in one of those meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous that you brought in, this lady brought in a grapevine. Her name was Clay. And on the back of that grapevine, she wrote her name and she wrote her phone number. And she said, Lisa, the day you get out, before you leave here, if you can, call me. And I'll come pick you up for a meeting. And if you can't, call me the minute you got home. And I did call her the minute I got home. She says, do you want me to come get you for the 5:30 or 8 o'clock? I said, I'll just meet you there. Because we did go to outside meetings when we were in the rooms of discovery. We went to the New Warrington group. That was the group I was most comfortable. We went to many groups, but that one was the most comfortable because they had the most people and you could hide in the back and they wouldn't see you. So I said, I'll just meet you there because, you know, I needed that escape just in case, you know, I got too uncomfortable. Because I don't know about you, I couldn't sit for a whole hour. I literally had to hold on to the chair and have chair marks just to sit for that whole hour because I just wanted to get up and run. Because I knew nothing about what the program was about. I knew I had a desire to stop drinking. I was working a tradition before I was working the steps. And they told us about getting sponsors when we would go out to different meetings while we were in the treatment center. See, you know, see who you can relate to and what you want out of someone. And, you know, there was this one lady that I saw, and she went to all those different meetings we went to, and her name was Kathy. And she spoke spiritually, not that she was very religious or anything. It's just the way her words came across. And I knew that's what I was missing. You know, that big donut hole, that big space within inside. So I asked her, I was scared to death, but I asked her to be my sponsor, and she said yes. I'd be more than happy to. Kathy and I were to journey the first 3 months in Alcoholics Anonymous, and she was definitely into the recovery, the unity, but definitely the service. So my first week there, she said, come early. We always had to show up early. If not a half hour, at least 45 minutes, because we had to get the meeting place ready. And it's a big meeting place. There could be anywhere from 30 people to 100 people at the time, depending on the meeting. And she said, now you have coffee to make. Your assignment is coffee for today. Well, I was not a coffee drinker, I'm sorry. So I did not know you did not take both of those 5-pound cans and put them into that one urn. So after the meeting, the women raised their hand and says, we don't particularly like growing hair on our chest. We need a new coffee maker. So I got bathroom duty, and I was perfectly fine with that because guess what? I didn't know how to have a conversation with anyone. Did not even know how to say hi. My head was still on the floor. I was so ashamed of what I had become. But I knew there was hope because Clay told me there was hope. And Clay shared her story with me that night. And I wanted to keep coming back because you told me I could keep coming back. And my husband definitely wanted me to keep coming back. He wanted nothing to do with me anymore. You know, when the kids were the same, they wanted nothing to do with me anymore. And here I thought I was only hurting myself. You know, from doing the toilets to doing the ashtrays to putting the tapes alphabetically, whatever it was. And then Kathy would start dragging us off to these things called workshops in that first 3 months. I didn't know what a workshop was. It was just get in the car, we're going. During the weeknight, Margaret and Kathy would say, okay, and we'd have 4 carloads of people. Get in the car, we're going to go to a meeting in Evergreen, you know, an hour, hour and a half away. You go to an 8 o'clock meeting. You don't get home till 1 o'clock in the morning because you stop at Shoney's afterwards, you know, just to chit-chat with the ladies and the men, whoever went. And I used to say, God, Kathy, I'm getting so tired. I can't do this during the week. She goes, no one's ever died sober. Don't worry about it. Or died of being tired is what she said. And I used to get so mad at her for that. But, you know, hindsight again, looking back, I was so grateful that my butt was dragged. You know, at 6 months, I got to chair my first meeting. And at that first ladies meeting, I occupied the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous as Martha for the first 6 months of my sobriety. And it's not because I didn't want you to know who it was. It's because I hated myself to the core. And when you said my name, I just wanted to cringe to the inner core. I didn't want to be me. I wanted to be you. My whole life, I wanted to be you. I wanted to look like you. I wanted to walk like you. I wanted to talk like you. You know? And I knew nothing about having a God in your life. And what I found out in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous is that AA works for people who believe in God. AA works for people who don't believe in God. AA doesn't work for people who believe they are God, and I didn't realize I was playing God in my life. Did not realize that. I began to learn about that physical allergy, that mental obsession in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't understand that. And I got to look hindsight. Every time I wanted to drink and didn't have it, how I obsessed over it. And I wanted to obsess more now on the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I learned that through the fellowship. Kathy got very sick when I was about 3-4 months sober, and I had to get her grand sponsor as a sponsor. And I was scared to death to Margaret because Margaret had years and years and years and years and years, and she was a psychologist and a psychiatrist, and she could read your body language, and she just knew everything about you, and it just scared the heck out of me. But anyway, when Kathy went into the hospital the next day, Margaret invited me over for a cup of coffee, and I'm sitting on Margaret's couch, and I'm just, you know, moving all different ways. And she says, are you comfortable, honey? And I'm going, oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, you know. Margaret was from Scotland and had this thick Scottish brogue. And some of their words mean a little bit different than our words. Kathy and I did the third step prayer, but that night Margaret and I also got on our knees and did the third step prayer, and we began on the journey. That next week, or within the next 2 weeks, we'd go over every Friday night, a couple nights a week, but mainly Friday night. And she would go over, we'd read from the book, and then she'd say, well, what do you think? And I don't want to think. You know, I can't think. I can't put two things together. I don't know. What do you think, Margaret? Well, it's not about me thinking, darling. It's about you thinking. Well, we get to the part where we need to do the fourth step, and we take the 12 and 12 out in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and she's telling me exactly how to do this, you know, and do you understand, darling? And it's, oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And I have a little bit of idea, but I really don't. I'm clueless. I'm totally clueless. So she says at the end of, we're talking 3 or 4 hours, she says, now I want you to go home and I want you to do a thorough house cleaning from top to bottom. Leave nothing unturned. 3 days later, I called her. I told her my baseboards, my ceiling fans, everything in my house, the grass outside, everything was completely clean. And she says, darling, I think we need to have another cup of coffee. And the reason I say that is I did a lot of things backwards, but I didn't pick up a drink. And I learned from that point on to say, I don't understand you. Because, see, I don't want you to think I'm stupid. I wasn't one of those that raised their hand in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous for probably that first year. I never raised my hand in school because I always thought, what if it's the wrong answer? You'll think I'm stupid. That was my whole life. And when you gave the wrong answer, I felt so bad for you. And you didn't care. Go figure. Margaret was heavily, heavily into service work. She, at that point, was serving the area assembly, but also district. So she had a stand for, she suggested, no, strongly suggested, is how she would put it, that first we serve our group in a capacity. And my home group at that time, the New Warrington Group in Pensacola, Florida, had 24 service positions. It was a big group. And she believed that we started at the top, which was archives. Learn about them archives, and that's where we started. We made a commitment for a year as an alternate. We made the commitment, if we were asked by the group, to continue on in the primary position. We didn't leave it because we didn't like it, because we need to learn about all of Alcoholics Anonymous, not just something we liked. And then we went on to public information for our home group, and then to corrections, and then to treatment. There was all different ones, and all the way up. And secretary and treasurer. And, you know, we're talking, what, 5 or 6 years here. I went to my first area assembly when I was a year sober, and I swore I was never going back again. There ain't no way. There was too many happy people there, and I had no clue what was going on those committees. And if I didn't know, I didn't want to feel stupid anymore. In the first and second year, we serviced District 2, and at district level, they trusted me with money. How do you like that? They trusted me with taking the minutes of the assembly. You know, it was all about just showing up and giving back, and that was a big thing with her. It's about giving back. I can sit here and tell you I'm real grateful for the fellowship and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, but it's an action word, and that's what she taught me. It's an action word. You know, who wants to go to 12-step call at 2 o'clock in the morning? But guess what? That's when we call at 2 o'clock in the morning. That was my first call to Alcoholics Anonymous years before, looking back hindsight. At 2 o'clock in the morning, I'm up for a drink because you know how we are. We drink so much and we think we're going to pass out for the night, and we don't. We wake up every 2 hours. And a Quincy Medicine Man came on TV. And he was talking to an auditorium full of high school teenagers, and because one of their friends got killed in a DUI. And I'll never forget what he said. He said, when you're sick and tired of being sick and tired, there's help. And after that, it went to a commercial, a public service announcement, a PSA with that circle and triangle. And again, this is looking hindsight. And it had a phone number. You know, I remember picking up and calling Alcoholics Anonymous, and I remember someone calling me back, and I don't know what I said, but I knew for a long time that the A police were going to be after me. You know, I didn't know what you were all about. And thank God for it. Thank God for the people who do the work for Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, we got busy, 3 years sober. Things were not going good at home. And again, with permission to share, my husband couldn't understand after the 30 days or the 90 days why I needed to go to these meetings, why I needed to pick up the phone to call sponsor, why other ladies called me in the middle of the night. And, you know, what could I say? I said, Reese, this is one day at a time. I got to do this one day at a time. And he was very resentful against you all. The first eating meeting he went to, I was probably 6 months sober. And you know, we saw all of us women hugging. So I was then called a lesbian. You know, not that it mattered, but he had no understanding. And all you guys were gay. You know, that's all you were there for. You were there to take our money and everything else. And I looked at him, I said, you're nuts, you know. You were nuts. We were just not. I wasn't a wife to him either. You know, he had a drunk wife from day one. And I never knew how to treat him. So that marriage was to end when I was 3 years sober. And what Margaret had suggested before it ended, because every day when I would go home, I would stop at my front door, I would say the serenity prayer because I knew what would happen when I got behind the door, and I always made sure I went to a meeting before I went home and made dinner. And it was going to be, you're going to be nothing but a drunk. You know, he was so resentful and so hateful that you people could sober me up, and he couldn't. And he couldn't understand that. He wanted no part of Al-Anon. So at 3 years sober, I couldn't live that way anymore. I threw the first punch at him, and I knew it was time to go. And my son, youngest son, got in between us. By that time, my eldest son had already gone off to serve the Army. So my sponsor suggested you give it 3 months, Lisa. You give it 3 good months, and you try to accept everything about that man, everything that you can't change. And I tried, and I tried, and I tried, and I made it 1 month, and I said, it's not going to work, Margaret. That's when I threw that first punch. and knew it was time to go. So my youngest son came to live with me. We moved out, and we got a nice little place, and I'm telling you, that is the first time in my whole life I've been self-supporting through my own contributions, and that was a big deal. It was a lot of fear there. And anything I had gone through, you know, the first 3 years of sobriety, you women, other ones that I hated and now that I love, because I wanted nothing to do with your women, and it all came down to me. It was not trusting me. It wasn't anything about not trusting you. And we had to go to those three ladies' meetings a week. Thank God for Margaret and her instilling that in us. And you're the ones that covered my butt. And every time I'd go to you one-on-one, because she told us about dumping in meetings. No dumping in meetings. And yet, the bottom line was every time you'd say, pray about it, Lisa, just pray about it. And I used to think, what good does prayer do? It's not getting better at home. It's not getting better with the kids. They're saying the same things to me as Daddy's saying to me. You're going to be nothing but a drunk. Get the heck out of my way, yada, yada, yada. You know, how could I have done that much damage? I'm a good mother. I'm a good mother. So anyway, I was to leave after a month. Barry would come live with me. And Barry didn't like his mother too much. Not much at all. Want to share with you a little bit about Barry. Barry had long hair, dreadlocks, big boy, about this tall, about this wide. And every time he'd walk by me, he'd push me and say, get the out of my way. And I'd say, Barry, you don't have to treat me that way anymore. I'm trying to do different, because that's what you taught me. Don't let anything come out that I'm going to regret. I caused enough harm in those kids' life. Barry hated his mother to the inner core. About, I was, got to tell you about this, a little over 3 years sober, somewhere about that, I was secretary to the home group, and we had to pick up the birthday cakes at the grocery store. At my home group, the person who's celebrating their birthday speaks, and you pick up the birthday cake. Well, Hurricane Opal was coming the next day. And you know how, storms up here, I guess the grocery stores get pretty crowded? Well, down there, they get pretty crowded, too, if they know a hurricane's coming. Anyway, this gentleman wanted to celebrate his birthday that Wednesday night. Had to celebrate it. So after work, I went to pick up the cake, and I could get nowhere near the bakery. I'm over here by the delicatessen, and the lady in the delicatessen yells to the lady in the bakery, which is probably about here to the back of the room, "The lady from Alcoholics Anonymous is here to pick up her cake." And I can tell you, those carts did not want what I had, because then I had a clear shot to that bakery. But what came out of that, that is the first time that I didn't hang my head down in shame. And I'm almost 3 years sober. I had fully conceded to my innermost self that I was alcoholic. And this was working for me. That's the awesome thing. Barry moved with me, and it was awful with Barry for the next 2 years. I was 5 years sober, and I hadn't heard a kind word from that child's mouth. Every time he said something to me, I'd say, Barry, we can disagree, but we don't have to be disagreeable. Barry, I hope God touches your life as he touched mine in that one instant. Yada, yada, yada. Everything that you shared with me, I would share with him. And he hated his mama to the utter core. One Saturday morning, I woke up, and there's a little note on my kitchen table. And it says, Mom, I just want you to know I love you. And I knew Barry committed suicide. Barry's room was black rug, black curtains, huck me, suck me, duck me music. I mean, everything. If you've ever seen a teenager that is miserable, you know, you look at him, you say, boy, he's miserable. That was my son. The black eyes. Barry never drank or smoked or did drugs. That I learned afterwards. I walked to his room shaking like a leaf because I didn't know what I was going to find. And I opened that door and I couldn't see anything because everything's black. Black rug, black curtains, and that music. And the music wasn't on that's usually on. He had some peaceful music on, and I knew. I knew he was dead. I peeled that little comfort off his little face, and his eyes popped open. And I wanted to kill him because he was alive. I didn't say that. And he just, you know, he said, Mom, did you get my note? And I said, yeah, Barry, what's going on? He said, we need to talk. I was shaking like a leaf to the utter core. I walked back to my bedroom, got my rosary beads because that became my comfort again. Walked back to his room, sat on the bed, and at that time he was throwing his cassettes in a big garbage can. He was taking down those posters that I couldn't stand off his wall. He was taking all the other stuff that he had hanging around that was not very nice and throwing it in the bag. And he sits down in a big hump and he looks at me and he says, Mom, you know how you've talked about God touching your life in an instant? I went, yeah, Barry. Now my prayer for all this time was, God, if it be thy will, may you touch his life as you did mine. Every day that was my prayer. He said, I went to a revival last night, Mom, and God touched my life. Barry was to graduate ministry school 6 years later. God touched his life in an instant. The power of prayer. I prayed that God would enter my life when I entered into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous because I didn't know how. Today I still don't know how, but he's entered into my life. I know if I take that step and do what the next right thing is, and sometimes I don't know what the next right thing is. If I don't show up to meetings, who am I going to meet? Who am I going to try to help? If I don't carry meeting into the in facilities, who am I going to meet? Who am I going to help? If it's all about me, it doesn't work. It just doesn't work. I got very involved in area, and I got to serve not only as secretary and treasurer, and that's not because I wanted it. Let me be the secretary. I'll do the paperwork. I was telling him, Milton, when you called me, and I just knew you were going to ask me to speak, I'm going, because it's not my gift. It's somebody else's gift, but I love to share about Alcoholics Anonymous. And I got to serve Area 1, Alabama, Northwest Florida, as their Panel 59 delegate and go up to New York and see the bigger picture. So now I know why Margaret had me go to these workshops. Now I know why Margaret had me go to these conventions. All this has finally gelled together about what Alcoholics Anonymous is about. It starts with recovery. It goes to unity. We stick together or we die alone. And it goes to giving it back. My attitude and gratitude towards God today is because of what I do today, what you taught me how to do today, what I didn't know how to do today. You know, every one of us is filled with the sunlight of the Spirit, and my wish is that it continues to flow through us into the lives of others. I don't know what time it is, but thank you for letting me share. Thank you for being here.